On the nuclear side, I would say that, and I hate to say this, but I have to be truthful, I think that we have not yet reached the peak of our environmental delays. I think the emphasis will shift from emission of radioactive material from power plants to other problems, including nuclear safety and release of radioactivity from reprocessing plants, waste disposal, safeguards, and miscellaneous problems like the GAO investigation, the LMFBR, and so on. There are a host of problems in this field, and any one of them provides good fodder for an environmentalist whose main point would be to try to effect delay regardless of what the other consequences would be. And I'm afraid with all of this ripe fruit to pick on, the environmentalists are going to live for a long time.
I think we had a demonstration of that at the equivalent session at the winter meeting. Larry Moss, who was then president of the Sierra Club, was on the panel, and he made the statement that despite the fact that the Sierra Club had just passed a resolution they were against any more nuclear plants, he himself was in favor of them because he thought they were safer than coal-fired plants when you consider death and health considerations in the mining of the coal. And I think
I read that.
Obviously that he's going to be after Mr. Brennan. I think what Mr. Land has said, the environmentalists are going to be here for a long time. We have a gentleman back here, and then we have one over here.
Paul Winkler, Golden Gate Switchboard Company. This is probably a reaction in public domain. To quote Mr. Sandberg, the worried class. If we can believe in the credibility of recent announcements by the media that the terrorist groups have now unified and have sufficient funds and are willing to pay any price for fissionable nuclear fuel, I question Mr. Searle's advisability of Mr. Searle's suggestion that we have worldwide trading and a futures market in atomic fuel. Would you care to comment on that?
No, that was not Mr. Searle's remark. That was my remark, so I better take responsibility for it.
Mr. Landis, I'm sorry, yes.
I didn't say exactly what you heard, apparently. I didn't say that we'd have worldwide trading in nuclear, in fabricated fuels. I said in uranium ore. I want a worldwide market in uranium ore, not in the fabricated fuel. And uranium ore doesn't pose any type of a safeguards problem. It's only after you've enriched the ore, you've run it through the very expensive gaseous diffusion or gas centrifuge process, that you have a safeguards problem. Because then, in the highly enriched state, you could take a certain amount of it, I won't mention how much, and make it into a bomb, even with rather unsophisticated equipment in your basement. However, I feel that the procedures and techniques, and again, I won't spell out what they are because they give away the line that we're pursuing to prevent this. The procedures and techniques that are being worked out are going to be so effective that this will not occur. I think that the thing that will probably occur is that the voluminous records that are going to have to be kept regarding the accountability of fissionable material, and here I include not only enriched U-235, but also plutonium-239 and uranium-233, the two bread fuels. The voluminous records are going to have to be kept, are sometimes going to have mistakes in them. Sometimes there will actually be misplaced fuel. And someone who knows about the records is going to be able to use that information illegally for blackmail, for extortion, or for all kinds of terrorist activity, merely by writing a letter to the proper authorities and saying, I happen to have in my possession 25 kilograms of certain enriched material, and if you want to be sure that I have it, look in your records of plant so-and-so, and you'll find that 25 kilograms is missing. He doesn't actually have to have it. All he has to know is that the records indicate that it's mislaid or gone or held up in the processes in an unusual manner. And this is the kind of thing that I think we're going to encounter more than actual theft.
I think the government has already demonstrated their inability to protect their documents. How do you propose that we carry on such a widespread protection system?
I must say that I don't see how we can protect the documents that well, particularly in view of the experience to date. However, I do think, I repeat this, I do think we can protect the action material well enough to prevent its diversion.
Okay, we have a gentleman over here.
Tom McDonald, Los Alamos Scientific Laboratory.
Would you repeat that, please?
Tom McDonald, Los Alamos. The question to Mr. Mack about the nuclear waste disposal problem. You mentioned in passing that this would probably be good fuel for environmentalists, and undoubtedly would be. You did not mention this problem as one of the major problems in your earlier talk. I was wondering where you see this problem as lying. Is it or is it not a major problem? And what do you see as a permanent solution to the radioactive waste disposal problem?
Well, I'm not an expert on radioactive waste disposal, but I have prepared some information on it because I thought that question would come up. I didn't list that as one of the three crucial problems because I feel that we have essentially already solved it from the technical standpoint. We have not solved it from the social or public relations standpoints, however. This is because of a certain amount of bureaucratic bungling and a certain amount of red tape that I feel is always required, and as I mentioned just a while ago, it will probably become more and more of a problem in the nuclear business. On the technical side, I feel that we have shown already that engineered safeguards have been developed to protect waste material for an indefinite period of time. It is perhaps more costly than we would like it to be, but the engineered facilities that we have constructed for such waste disposal above ground are adequate. The same type of approach could be used below ground. Again, the entire complex would have to be monitored so that if there is any leakage at any time, it could be detected and you could use your reserve tanks or reserve vaults to transfer the material to. This, as I say, may be more expensive than we would like it to be, but it can be done and can be kept going indefinitely. If you talk about a real permanent disposal, that is burying the material in salt mines or salt deposits or some other geologic formation that is going to be there essentially forever, I think that too has been essentially worked out from the technical standpoint. But selecting the state where we want to put this material and convincing the people it ought to be put there and that the process is really safe enough is a massive public education problem, and that has not yet been done.
Gentleman over here. Oh, a lady over here.
I'm Barbara Donner, and I'm privileged to be here with my husband today. I appreciate that the purpose of the panel is to discuss fuels for the next 10 years or so, but I can't help but be concerned with the availability of fuels in, say, 50 or 100 or even 200 years from now. Are we using up fuels faster than the Earth can provide or replenish them? And if so, what considerations are being made to meet this eventual exhaustion of material?
Mr. Searle?
Well, I guess one resorts to technology here as a way out. If we get the breeder reactor, a viable breeder reactor, or if we get nuclear fusion, we'll have, I think, many millions of years of fuel. There's enough sunlight falling on the U.S. in half a day, if we could capture it all, to supply a year's current requirements. Now, solar's going to come on slowly, in my opinion. It's much higher capital cost in most uses and the like, but it is there. The solar if we need it. I think in time we will be able to capture some of the deep heat of the earth, too. There's a lot of shallow geothermal, the type of the geysers here in California and the like, but when you get tapping some of the deeper earth's heat, there's a vast amount there. The trouble with practically all of these technologies today is they're just considerably higher cost than we're used to. So I don't think we're really in a danger of robbing future generations for at least tens of thousands of years, but we may make things higher cost for them.
I'd like to comment on that, too. The most recent U.S. Bureau of Mines estimate on coal reserves is about 434 billion tons, and this is what they call demonstrated reserves, which means it's at a place where you can mine it. Now, this, if you figure we're going to be producing, say, 1.5 billion by 85, we have a lot of coal in the ground. But I have to agree with the previous statement. We must begin and carry forth over many years and decades a concerted research and development program so that, A, we use the fuels we have more efficiently, and, B, we develop new sources as they are needed. There isn't anything that, with proper R&D efforts, with proper conservation efforts, and with rational land use patterns, that we can be assured for generations and generations that there will be quite adequate energy resources.
Mr. Searle, Mr. Landis, Mr. Searle had a couple of nuclear ifs in there, if the breeder and if fusion. Would you like to comment on how big an if that is?
Well, when you talk about, say, 100 to 200 years from now, I don't think it's a matter of whether the breeder will work or not. I don't think it's a matter of whether there's enough uranium in the earth or not. I think it's a matter of whether we can develop solar power or whether we can develop fusion power in time. I think I agree with Milt that solar power will come along. It will take a long time. The capital costs are high. For example, we now figure, we're doing some work on this, that to make it economic, we have to prepare and surface the ground to catch the sunlight at a cost of 7 cents per square foot. And we don't know anybody who can do that. On the fusion side, I personally have more optimism. I think that there are several fusion devices that will work eventually, and I believe that one or two of them will probably be economic. However, again, it will take a long time to reach commercial viability. We're concentrating on the electromagnetic confinement method. Other companies and laboratories are concentrating on the laser fusion method. We feel that the electromagnetic confinement method will take 50 years to get into commercial operation. However, that is before the time that you're talking about, and unless we're woefully off, I believe it will occur. And then you must realize that fuel is no longer a problem, because you can get enough deuterium out of 1 gallon of seawater for one of these fusion devices to generate as much energy as 300 gallons of pure gasoline.
Let me ask you a question. Couldn't we, if we just were forced to, use fusion today? As you remember, some years back, either Los Alamos or Livermore had a scheme for exploding a bomb underground and recovering the heat like geothermal. I'm not saying, you know, it's commercial or anything like that, but if when we're forced to fusion today, I suspect that you could use that.
Well, you're certainly making the conversation more interesting than it could probably. I think there would be so much outcry from the populace of the world on that, Milt, that we wouldn't be allowed to do it. But assuming we were allowed to do it, I think it would be a very inefficient way to do it.
Agreed.
Because it would be difficult to prevent most 99% of the heat from just disseminating into the Earth's crust.
Gentlemen?
Mike Bertolette, Philadelphia Electric. My question is in a somewhat different direction. It has to do with the manpower, technical manpower, including women power, of course, required to supply and to execute this tremendous expansion of our energy supply and conversion facilities, even in the next 10 years. Is there data available, and what efforts are being made to stimulate the production, shall we say, or the development and training of that necessary manpower?
I guess I'll start it.
Mr. Brennan?
In the coal industry, one of the critical components, as I mentioned in my opening remarks, is manpower, and one of the most critical components of that component is the training of technically qualified people. Coal mining is a very complex operation. We need mining engineers, we need electrical engineers, we need trained technicians. Unfortunately, in the past decade or so, the supply of these people has declined very dramatically. And we find once eminent mining engineering schools, for example, are closing down or merging with other departments within their respective universities. There is now an attempt being made at both the federal government level and also at the state levels to reinstitute and reinvigorate schools of mining engineering to provide technical training for technicians short of engineering. But when you consider that the total graduating class of our mining engineering schools is less than 200, and that I know at least two companies that need more than that, the magnitude of the problem is there. And it is an area, I think, that certainly the coal industry and I suspect the energy industry as in total has to address itself to, and we have to get ourselves somehow or another in the education field, or we're going to be very critically deficient as we go along.
I think that's a very important point to make. I'm glad it was made. I believe in the nuclear industry, our bottleneck is eventually going to be money and men, and maybe the manpower problem will be even worse than the money problem, because we are not training enough engineers in this country for the predicted energy expansion that we are talking about today, much less all the other uses for engineers that we have coming along. So unless we get at that problem right away, I'm afraid that that will be the eventual bottleneck.
Well, it's not only engineers, it's construction workers also on the whole chain, I think.
Mm-hmm. Which reminds me, EPRI headquarters are right across the street from Syntex, and I wonder if we'll have enough people to operate their production. Well, time for one more question. I think I saw a hand back here.
My name is Wolf. I'm with International Engineering Company. I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Landis. I'd like to request his opinion, basically, on the merit of placing greater emphasis on the gas-cooled fast breeder program, something to parallel the liquid metal program demonstration plan. If he thinks this is so, what kind of policy changes would be necessary, funding for R&D programs and so forth, in order to implement this?
Well, that's quite a sizable chunk of information to give you in a short period of time. I'll try to condense it because I know time is short. There has been a major argument going on in this nation, as you undoubtedly know from the sophistication of your question, I gather you do, between the advocates of the liquid metal fast breeder reactor and the advocates of the gas-cooled fast breeder reactor. On the liquid metal fast breeder reactor side, the people who espouse that particular concept are saying that this nation can only afford the money required to do a good job on one breeder alone. Furthermore, there is the manpower problem that we just talked about. And if we want to get enough good people with enough money and facilities in back of them to do the job right, we should concentrate on one breeder concept. It's such a difficult technical problem. On the other hand, the people who espouse the gas-cooled fast breeder reactor are saying that you don't need to spend nearly as much money to develop the gas-cooled fast breeder reactor as you do to develop the liquid metal fast breeder reactor, because the gas-cooled fast breeder reactor is based on a technology already developed, namely the helium system and component technology of the high-temperature gas-cooled reactor. Many of the control systems, components, and other things are exactly the same in the two concepts. Whereas the liquid metal fast breeder reactor, developing as it is out of a light water reactor technology, can use very little of the light water reactor technology in building that type of plant. My personal opinion is, and this differs somewhat from a recently announced report by EPRI, Dr. Starr just put out a report saying that the gas-cooled fast reactor is at least 15 years behind the liquid metal fast breeder reactor. I don't think that's correct. I think that the gas-cooled fast reactor may be a year or two behind the liquid metal fast breeder, but that's about all. I also believe that the gas-cooled fast breeder reactor could add something to the overall program in that it has certain basic safety features which the LMFBR does not have. Furthermore, as you probably know, its coolant is very benign, doesn't react with anything. Helium is the coolant, whereas the sodium, the coolant in the liquid metal fast breeder reactor, is a real bad actor, and if you let any of that get out into the plant, you're either going to have a sodium fire or a pretty bad reaction with water. Nevertheless, I do recognize the problems of manpower and money limitations. So what I propose is that in view of the fact that we do have a good converter reactor economy going, LWRs and HTGRs, that we stretch that out, slow down the entire breeder program, and develop both the LMFBR and the GCFR simultaneously, one reinforcing the other, and perhaps helping to solve the problems of the other, particularly on the fuel side.
Okay. Well, I think that's it's 5 o'clock, a few minutes after, and I think we've really taxed these gentlemen to the fullest, and I think that the message came through to me sort of negatively, perhaps, but no one refuted Mr. Gunning's statement that the population was going to increase. Nobody said there's going to be zero growth in population. And I think all the gentlemen said, as long as we have population growth, we're going to have economic growth, or else we're going to completely lose the welfare of the nation and the people. And I think that that is true. I agree with it fully. And I think we have to look forward to doing our part, and I hope that Mr. Gunning and his people can find a way for us to raise the money to do it. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
It's great to get the money.
What's that?
I said if they raise the rates.
Yeah, it's a terrible problem, though, because a lot of the utilities are not going to be
Well, Brian, you're asking all the questions.
We've
gone to
6:30.
Yeah, yours, Michael, coming out.
Yeah, it's non-related.
I wanted to say, John, you did a very fine job. Probably don't remember where they left. You were out there.
I'm trying to get to a play here.
Certainly, we preferred to have a station. Maybe some people have to bring the electric.